So that will activate transcription, will actually facilitate transcription to bring the ground zero state to the middle derepressed state. The second way of doing this is through so-called chromatin remodeling complexes. There are many chromatin remodeling complexes. They can remodel your chromatin, as the name implies, in an ATP-dependent manner. What do I mean, remodel chromatin? They move your nucleosomes away from the important sites. For example, if you want to assemble your PIC around the TALA box initiator, downstream promoter elements, so on and so forth, you need to clear up a landing patch for your plane, for your helicopter to land. So those ATP-dependent chromatin remodeling complex will do this kind of a job. They move your nucleosomes away from this important piece of DNA, clear up a landing patch so that you can form your pre-initiation complex. So that's the second way of activating chromatin for transcription. The third way is to create so-called histone coat. Okay? So on the other hand, in other words, when your histones are undergoing modifications, either acetylation, as indicated in this case, sometimes could be phosphorylation, sometimes could be other types of modifications, they actually create special code in the histone molecules that can be recognized or can serve to recruit other transcription factors or co-activators. Okay? And a good example of this is the modification of histone on lysine number 9 to change it into acetylysine. This will be recognized by a special type of protein that contains a domain called bromodomain. Bromodomain is designed to recognize diacetylated histone tails whenever you have two acetylysine residues present in the termini of histone molecules. Very often, those modified termini, the acetylated termini, will be recognized by any proteins that contain the bromodomain. So the bromodomain is sort of serving as a module for recognition of those modified acetylated histone tails. One of the proteins that has a bromodomain, which we didn't go into any detail, I skipped that slide several lectures ago, is contained in the TF2D transcription factor. Remember, TF2D consists of TBP and many TBP-associated factors called TAFs. The largest size TAF, called TAF250, contains a bromodomain. So this bromodomain will recognize acetylated histone tails, will facilitate the binding of your TF2D to the TALA box, to the initiator region, through the interaction of bromodomain with acetylated histone termini. So you can imagine that by modifying histones, creating histone coat, obviously, this implies that there are many different types of combinations of modifications. Those will provide a recognition mode for proteins or transcription activators or co-activators that will recognize this modified histones to facilitate the loading or recruitment of transcription factors to the chromatin template. A good example, as I said, is this TF2D using the bromodomain in the TAF250 subunit to recognize the modified acetylated histone tails. So those are the three different ways to activate chromatin for transcription. Now we're going to spend time to look at every category in more detail. The first one is modification by acetylation. This is the most common type of modification that will activate chromatin for transcription. Okay? Let's take a look at exactly why modification of histone lysine residues by this acetyl group will actually change the behavior of nucleosome, which might be good for transcription. You have already known from Professor Albert's lectures that the nucleosome consists of 1.75 turns of DNA wrapped around of this 8 molecules of histone proteins called histone octamer. The end termini of those histone molecules happen to be on the surface of this ball, okay, as indicated by those thin lines. And the termini usually consist of positive charge residues. After all, histones are highly positive charge, basic proteins. They have many positive charge amino acids. Positive charge amino acids turns out to be concentrated in the N-terminal line of those histone molecules, and they happen to be on the outside surface of this histone octamer. Your DNA consists of sugar phosphate backbone, which basically is negative charged, right? So obviously, through charge-charge interaction, the histone termini will wrap around your sugar phosphate backbone to form very tight interaction. This will render the DNA wrapped around this histone octamer in a repressed state because they are not recognizable by sequence-specific transcription factors or basal transcription machinery. So you cannot get good transcription when your chromatin DNA is in this so-called repressed state because the histone termini having a lot of positive charges, they wrap around the DNA, you know, interacting with your negative charged DNA sugar phosphate backbone, keeping it in a very super condensed state. Okay? I wouldn't call it condenser, repressed state. Just imagine that this nucleosome is in a repressed state, that the DNA sequences are not accessible for your transcription factor or your TF2D or whatever factor to recognize. Upon acetylation of the histone termini, you can see the situation is different. Now those N-terminis of the histone molecules are, you know, released. So they loosen up their grip on the DNA molecules. So this nucleosome is considered in an active or competent state. Now your proteins can recognize the DNA. This is through acetylation of lysine residues. The reason is lysine has amino groups, has epsilon amino groups that has its positive charge. That contributes to the positive charge of this amino acid side chain. Upon acetylation mediated by the HAT enzyme, histone acetyltransferase, there is a transfer of acetyl group from acetyl-CoA, this is a donor of acetyl group, to modify the free amino group so that upon the acetylation of this amino group, you can see that the positive charge get lost. So this modification by acetylation neutralizes the positive charge of the lysine residue. That's why they loosen up their grip on negative charge DNA backbone. And then you have the active competent state for transcription. Okay, so this illustrates why or how acetylation can induce a conformational change in the core histones, which is beneficial for transcription activation, for induction of transcription, because you convert the repressed state of nucleosomes into an active competent state of nucleosomes. Exactly how would you bring in the histone acetyltransferase, the HAT enzyme, to your nucleosomes to activate transcription? That is the subject that we will look at immediately. Okay? Exactly how would you imagine that a transcription activator can activate transcription through modification of histone termini by acetylation? Here is a well-characterized example first shown in yeast. Right now, this is considered to be a, you know, universal type of situation, but this specific example is from yeast, baking yeast. Okay, this illustrates the fact that a sequence-specific transcription factor called GCN4, remember GCN4 belongs to the basic leucine zipper family, GCN4 protein can actually bring in a protein complex. One of the active components of this protein complex is a HAT, is the histone acetyltransferase. So how does it do this? It turns out that GCN4 will recognize a specific DNA sequence. In yeast, it's called UAS. Remember, it's called the upstream activating sequence. It's equivalent of the enhancers in mammalian cells. GCN4 binding to the UAS is incredibly strong. So very often this interaction can occur whether the DNA is in nucleosome or it's actually free of histone molecules. It doesn't matter. In this particular example, as illustrated in this picture, it seems like the UAS happens to be in between the two nucleosomes. So it's in a free region. But it's actually shown that even when this UAS is wrapped around histone octamer, part of the nucleosome, the binding of GCN4 to the UAS has such a high affinity that it doesn't care. It will bind very strongly. this binding event initiates a chain of events, basically. It will actually bring in a protein complex through an interaction of the activation domain of GCN4 with a component of this protein complex. And this protein complex has an active component called GCN5, which is a HAT, is a histone acetyltransferase. So by recruitment of this histone acetyltransferase activity to the neighborhood of this UAS, you can imagine that this enzyme will actually add acetyl groups to a lot of substrates in the neighborhood. Those substrates, of course, are the N-terminals of those histone H3, H4 molecules, which are part of the nucleosome. So this illustrates that a GCN4 protein can activate transcription by not contacting the basal transcription machinery or coactivators or SRB mediator complex or any of the basal transcription factors. Instead, it activates transcription by bringing in a HAT. And this HAT can modify the local histone molecules through acetylation. This changes the behavior, the conformation in this area, so that nucleosomes in this area are considered to be hyperacetylated, so they are in a competent, accessible state. Now you can have your TF2D begin to recognize the TALA box initiator somewhere over here, and then setting up the PIC, pre-initiation complex, for transcription. Yes, you have a question. Distance away, yes. Yeah. Yes, through long distance interaction, remember the DNA can loop out, then you can facilitate this kind of interaction. Very often requires some kind of coactivator or SRB to mediate this interaction. But eventually you can imagine that if this is far away, it can still have effect at the promoter region through looping out the intervening DNA. So this is actually a very good example illustrating how a transcription activator can actually activate transcription through modifying histone tails, through activate chromatin to achieve transcription. Obviously, the opposite is true. This is for transcription activation. You can imagine that you can have the reverse situation, the opposite situation, to mediate transcription inhibition, which is shown on the next slide. Over here, we have, instead of a UAS, this is once again in East, we have a URS upstream repressive sequence number one. The URS1 is recognized by a different protein called UME6. Unlike GCN4, this factor is a transcription repressor, so the domain that makes contact with this multi-subunit complex is called RD for repression domain, not AD, not activation domain. This is RD. The DNA binding domain, DBD, makes direct contact with URS1. Once again, the binding of UME6 with URS1 is quite specific and strong, very high affinity. So it really doesn't matter whether this sequence is actually wrapped around nucleosomes or actually free of nucleosomes, in between two nucleosomes. It doesn't matter. For the simplicity of illustration, this is drawn as if this is were in two nucleosomes, but you can imagine that this interaction is so strong it doesn't really care where this is actually located. Okay? The interaction of UME6 with URS1 will bring in a multi-subunit complex, a different complex. This is not our GCN5 complex. This is the opposite of our GCN5 complex. This complex contains two mentionable subunits. One is called SYN3. SYN3 protein makes a direct contact with the repression domain of UME6. The other important subunit that worth mentioning is RPD3, because this is the enzymatic subunit of this complex. It contains the opposite of the HAP enzyme. Instead of adding acetyl group to lysine residues, this guy, RPD3, can remove through a process deacetylation to remove acetyl groups from histone termini. So acetylation is a reversible process. You can have acetylation, you can also have deacetylation mediated by two different enzymes. So RPD3 happens to be the other side of the coin. By removing acetyl groups from N-termini of histone molecules. Just like what we described previously, if you remove acetyl groups, then this restores the positive charge to those histone termini. They will begin interacting with your sugar phosphate backbone of your DNA in a very strong manner, very tightly. Then you will render the DNA in a highly, highly compressed state wrapped around the nucleosome so that they are not accessible for any of your TF2D or any of the factors recognition. This shuts down transcription. Okay? So this is one important mechanism to inhibit transcription, not in a very direct manner, but through bringing the so-called intermediate naked state, equivalent to naked de-repressed state, to the ground zero state, to make them into deep ground zero state in order to repress transcription. Okay? The question is, whether you remove acetyl group from histone termini, is it enough to repress transcription? Turns out that the answer is no. It's necessary but not sufficient to repress transcription. Very often, modification of histone termini can occur or must occur in concerted fashions. So there are additional modifications of histone termini in order to really make it into either hyperactive or ground zero, highly, highly repressed state. We are talking about another modification called methylation. Okay? As I said, histone deacetylase, those enzymes called HDAC, okay? Histone deacetylase activity or something, HDAC in short, this will remove the acetyl group from lysine number 9 of histone 3. Okay? This happens to be the ninth position of a lysine. But removing this acetyl group is only one step toward the final ground zero state of repression of transcription. It turns out that the deacetylated histone H3 is also recognized by another enzyme called the histone methyltransferase, HMT, to add the methyl group to the same lysine residue. This will indeed keep this histone H3 in a really, really repressed state. Okay. So as you can see that it's a coordination of deacetylase, HDAC, and the histone methyltransfer, HMT, in order to keep this histone or the nucleosome in an inactive ground state. The reverse is also similar, taking two steps. In order to bring in the inactive ground state, you have to initially remove the methyl group by an enzyme called LSD1. This happens to be recently identified the protein in Shi Yang's laboratory at Harvard. Many years ago, people think that only acetylation, deacetylation is a reversible process, whereas methylation is only a one-way event. They thought that there's no such thing called histone demethylase. We cannot remove methyl group. And he and his colleagues showed that's not right. There are a specific protein called LSD1 that can actually remove this methyl group, and then this will serve as a substrate for your HAC enzyme to make it into a de-repressed state by adding the acetyl group on the lysine residue at the lysine number 9. Okay? And this, of course, is a very, very important discovery. It shows that, like acetylation, methylation is also a reversible process. You can have histone methyltransferase to add a methyl group to this residue. You can also use LSD1 to remove this methyl group to make it into a substrate for acetylation. So this is a completely reversible process for both type of modifications. The reason several other lysine residues, this K, and this K, are also colored in red is because the modification of histone H3 is not restricted to lysine number 9. There are other types of modifications, acetylations, methylations, so on and so forth, on other lysine residues. Sometimes there are also phosphorylation as an important modification of a serine residue, serine number 10 over here, immediately after lysine number 9. So you can imagine that a histone molecule can be differentially modified under different physiological conditions. Some of those may have only these two lysines acetylated. Sometimes you may have these three methylated, whatever, under all kinds of physiological conditions, you can have combinatorial events, consequences. So this creates what we call histone code, because if you have different modifications, each one of them can have either methylation or acetylation. Sometimes some of those can also have phosphorylation. You can imagine that you can create a secret code that can be recognized by specific factors that will recognize those kind of different codes to facilitate the loading of transcription factor, either a repressor sometimes or a transcription activator sometimes, to give you a very dynamic regulation of transcription. So with this, we get into the domain, which we actually don't have time to go into. This is we're talking about global regulation of a big chunk of DNA, chromatin regulation, sometimes through global regulation, to give you either so-called euchromatin, which generally is competent for transcription. Sometimes you have those heterochromatin, which have a large chunk of a chromatin that are in a super condensed state, so there's no, absolutely no transcription happening within this heterochromatin region. So those will involve a lot of those modification events. Yes, we have a question. It's mostly through recognition by other transcription repressors. So methylated lysine will be recognized by a whole bunch of different proteins that are actually important for repression of transcription. I told you that acetylated lysine very often is recognized by proteins containing bromo domain. Bromo, B-R-O-M-O, bromo domain. We didn't go into any of those bromo domain. And there is also another domain called chromo domain. Those proteins that are repressing transcription very often contain this so-called chromo domain. The chromo domains are recognizing the methylated lysine residues. So you can imagine that this serves as some kind of recognition signal for a whole bunch of transcription repressors to keep this chromatin in a heterochromatin region, in a highly, highly ground zero state, highly condensed state, so there's no transcription happening within this region. Sometimes those boundary elements, those insulator elements, also involve methylation of histones, involving condensing the chromatin into a ground zero state, so there's no transcription. Not only there's no transcription, there's even no signal can pass through this region, so your enhancers can work in a domain-specific fashion within the boundaries set up by the insulator elements. So with this, we talk about the modification of histones. And I promise that we're also going to look at chromatin remodeling as the second way of activating transcription by moving the nucleosomes around, you know, moving away from the important region in an ATP-dependent manner. The first chromatin remodeling complex was identified in yeast through a genetic method, and it's called switch-sniff complex. You know, the important complex has two subunits, switch-sniff. And later on, it was found that this actually is a kind of a quite general, ubiquitous factor conserved across species. In human, we also have human switch SNF with a small letter H stands for this in human sapiens species. Okay. In addition to the switch SNF complex, later on, people find there are many other chromatin remodeling complexes in higher eukaryotes, HACF, RSF, etc. All of them contain an important ATPase component, as can be implied from the expected from the existence of ATPase element, a component in this complex. This complex must hydrolyze ATP using the ATPase activity, and the energy coming from hydrolysis ATP is used to help moving the nucleosomes around, so that you can clear up the landing patch for your important transcription factors to recognize, to land, okay, in an ATP-dependent manner, induce changes in chromatin structure. Okay, so this slide is a little busy slide. It illustrates all the known acrobatic acts that we people know those chromatin remodeling complex can do. not all of them are actually directly related to transcription regulation. We only know that those things can happen in test tube. You know, if you put in something that you're adding your remodeling complex, the ATP, you will actually have an outcome illustrated over here. It doesn't mean that all of those are related to transcription activation. It only says that under the conditions in your test tube, in the presence of those modifying enzymes, if you're giving it the proper substrate plus ATP, this enzyme can do this kind of acrobatic acts. Okay? First of all, is so-called creation of altered DNase-1 cleavage pattern. And this is actually useful. And you can use this to measure the activity of your chromatin remodeling complex by looking at the DNA sensitivity of the DNA. As you know that from your DNase-1 footprinting, you already know that when the DNA is recognized by a specific protein, usually this will protect the cleavage by DNase-1. Same thing, if your DNA is wrapped around nucleosomes in a very tight manner, particularly those unacetylated histone termini that wrap around the DNA, making it very tight, if you add your DNase-1, you cannot make a cleavage on this DNA. Unless you put in histone chromatin remodeling complex and ATP, as you can see that there might be some change of the manner of DNA wrapping around the histone octamer. There might be some relaxed state or something. So this region of DNA now becomes accessible for your DNase-1 to recognize, to make a cut. So you can use this as a method to see whether your remodeling complex is working or not. Okay? Second one is, it's very weird. This obviously does not necessarily have any physiological consequence. When you have two separate nucleosomes, see, they are not physically linked. When you're putting your remodeling complex and ATP, you can create a very artificial situation, having the DNA from the first nucleosome somehow mysteriously wrap around the second nucleosome, also having the DNA from the second nucleosome somehow mysteriously wrapping around the first nucleosome. You create this kind of artificial dinucleosome species. As I said, this does not necessarily mean that this occurs in vivo or in any transcription situation. But what I'm trying to say is, those remodeling complex in the presence of ATP can really do a lot of strange things, okay, such as this. This is also another approach that you can use to monitor the activity of your remodeling complex. If you have a piece of radioactive labeled DNA, you add it to this mixture containing your nucleosome, containing, of course, unlabeled DNA, co-DNA wrapped around the nucleosome. You're putting your remodeling complex plus ATP, the end product is, now you see the co-DNA is exchanged off the histone octamer, whereas the P32 labeled DNA, red color, now is wrapped around the histone octamer. So there is an exchange reaction going on. In this situation, you can create altered translational positions of histone octamer. This is very easy to understand because this directly involves moving around the histone octamers around DNA. If your histone octamer normally sitting near the end of this piece of DNA, by adding your remodeling complex, ATP, after incubation, you can have your nucleosome somewhere in the middle of this piece of DNA. Okay? Over here, chromatin remodeling complex can also facilitate assembly and spacing of nucleosomes. Okay? If you give the reaction a piece of naked DNA, histone molecules, a variety of histones, histone H2A, 2B, histone H3, H4, so on and so forth, plus another protein called NAP1, this is a so-called the histone chaperone protein. It facilitates the folding of histones, facilitates the assembly of histone on the naked DNA. On top of that, you're adding your chromatin remodeling complex, the ATP, you can assemble perfect spaced nucleosomes along this piece of DNA. On the other hand, if you provide the nucleosome, already assembled nucleosome, but the spacing is not evenly spaced out, after the reaction, you can also have this evenly spaced out nucleosomes. Okay? In this example, if you have DNA containing so-called inverted repeats, you're adding your chromatin remodeling complex, ATP. After that, you can have this kind of very artificial so-called cruciform formation. Does this have any physiological relevance? I don't know. But this is something that this chromatin remodeling complex can do if you're giving it the sequence with this kind of inverted repeats in the sequence. In model G over here, we have altered restriction enzyme access. This is quite useful. This is very similar to the creation of altered DNase1 cleavage pattern. This is very often used as a method to monitor remodeling, chromatin remodeling. Okay? Exactly how this works. Let's see, you have two restriction enzyme cleavage sites. One is recognized by restriction enzyme A, such as BAMH1. The other one by your B, such as ECOR1, for example. If your DNA is tightly wrapped around the histone optimer, A site could be inaccessible for cleavage. You add your enzyme, you don't cleave the DNA because the DNA is actually tightly wrapped around histone optimer. If you add your second enzyme, enzyme B, because the B site is in between the two nucleosomes, it's free, you can make a cut. After you add your chromatin remodeling complex and ATP, you can shift this by having the A now in an exposed region, whereas B is now inaccessible. So by monitoring the cleavage accessibility by restricting enzyme A and B, you know that there must be some moving around the nucleosomes. Otherwise, you won't expect this thing happening, right? Because A normally is not accessible, but after moving the nucleosomes around, now it becomes available. So, same thing for this. You can use this to monitor activity of chromatin remodeling complex. Finally, if you have a piece of circular DNA that contains nucleosomes, if you remove the protein by, you know, proteinase K treatment, phenylchloroform extraction, you isolate naked DNA, as you know that the nucleosomes will render the DNA in a superhelical structure, so you have a superhelical turns in the naked DNA. You can actually see that by running an agrocell under proper conditions. However, if you adding your histone chromatin remodeling complex plus ATP plus topoisomerase 1, you can look having seemingly similar type of nucleosome array on a circular DNA. However, if you remove all the proteins, the superhelical nature of the DNA is different. So in other words, the remodeling complex plus ATP can change the topological number of the circular DNA. Okay? Because there are changes in the way that the DNA will wrap around nucleosomes, so you have a different superhelical turns. So all of those things can be visualized in test tube. If you put in proper chromatin remodeling complex and ATP, some of those are obviously important for transcription. For example, this one, you can imagine that by moving the nucleosomes laterally along this piece of DNA, you can create landing patch for transcription factors to bind. So obviously, this is very important for transcription. Even this is important for transcription. But some of those may not necessarily related to transcription regulation in vivo. The only purpose is to show that chromatin remodeling complex plus ATP can really do a lot of things. Okay? Any questions about this? All right. So with all the discussion of this modifications of histone termini and remodeling complex in an ATP-dependent manner, how do we fit all of these things into our global view of transcription? Okay? Transcription regulation. Now you have to realize that transcription of a given promoter can be achieved by multiple different things at multiple layers. So this is a multi-layer ensemble of multi-subunit complexes, many complexes. This is a plural form, many different complexes. They are all multi-subunits that can actually facilitate transcription regulation. DA stands for promoter distal activators. PA stands for promoter proximal activators. So those transcription activators that are recognizing either the enhancers over here or the promoter proximal elements, they have many, many targets to see. Sometimes they, like what we discussed before, they directly communicate with your basal transcription machinery. through co-regulators, co-activators, SRB mediators, so on and so forth. They make direct contacts with your basal transcription machinery to give you so-called direct direct activation of transcription, you know, as if this is a naked DNA. Some of those transcription factors binding to the enhancer elements all could be binding to the promoter proximal elements. They contribute to the activated transcription by modifying either histone tails or chromatin structures by bringing either histone modifiers. Okay, they interact with histone modifiers such as GCN4 interacting with the GCN5 containing complex. They can bring those type of complex to modify the histone termini, changing your global picture of nucleosome structure. Some of those can also interact with chromatin remodeling complex, which SNF complex is one of them, and then the transcription factor can talk to those chromatin remodeling complex to modify the chromatin structure by moving the nucleosomes away from important sites. You can have all of those things going on, sometimes in a sequential manner, sometimes all occurring at pretty much the same time. You can have the final activation transcription. Some of those are from the derepressed state to the final activated state when the interaction is between the transcription factor and the basal transcription machinery. Some of those are involving bringing the ground zero state to the middle derepressed state. We're talking about those chromatin remodeling, histone modification, so on and so forth. So when you look at transcription regulation of any given gene, it really consists of at least these two parts, okay, from the ground zero state to the intermediate derepressed state, the equivalent of naked DNA state, and then from this middle state to the final activated state for this transcription. As I said, for any given gene, events may change. You know, some of those may not involve any chromatin remodeling. Some of those may not involve any specific histone modification. Some of those may contain both. Some of those may actually in a well-studied example of yeast gene, the first event is actually bringing a histone modification enzyme to modify the histones. Then this helps the loading of the PIC over here, and then it's found that the some components over here can also bring a chromatin remodeling complex, and then you have the final transcription activation. In a well-studied mammalian gene, the order is different. We have the transcription factor bringing a chromatin remodeling complex first, which can also bring a histone modifier, those acetyltransferase, HEC enzymes, which creates situation to facilitate loading of the PIC. So really it depends upon particular specific genes. Those different factors, sometimes they don't have to be here all at once. Sometimes they can come in different orders. Okay? So the bottom line is regulation can be achieved at many, many different levels. With this, I have to introduce you another technique that's used very, very frequently these days in laboratories to study interaction of particular protein, a specific protein, with chromatin template. And this is different from the previous two methods that are used to study protein-DNA interaction, one being the DNA-SMAD footprinting, the other one is gel shift method. Both methods are used in your test tube, in vitro. This method is used in living cells, in live cells. This is an in vivo method. It allows you to study the interaction of a given transcription factor or any DNA binding or chromatin template interacting protein. It doesn't have to be a transcription factor. It could be a factor involving DNA replication or repair or whatever. You can use this method to study their interaction with chromatin template. Okay, in vivo, that's the primary goal of this method. Secondary goal is sometimes you can also get rough information about where this factor may bind along this piece of chromatin DNA. It won't give you very precise information, unlike DNA-SMAD footprinting, which will give you base pair information, give you a footprinting, telling you exactly on this piece of DNA where the binding site is. This one, the chromatin immunoprecipitation chip assay, will not give you precise information about where it binds, but give you rough information. It will become clear in a few minutes. So this method is called chromatin immunoprecipitation, CHIP. Immunoprecipitation, of course, involves precipitation, getting something precipitated down. By using an immuno method, obviously that implies you have to use antibodies. Okay? So this is a chromatin using an immuno antibody to precipitate the proteins bound to chromatin, basically. This is called CHIP. So exactly how would you do that? Suppose you want to study the binding of this two pink color transcription factor interacting with this chromatin DNA. You have nucleosomes indicated by the yellow circles, okay? And the factor binding, those two factors interacting with chromatin template next door to the transcription start site, close to the transcription start site. You begin by adding chemical compound formaldehyde, which you use to fix everything in living cells. You fix all the proteins, of course, also histone molecules, everything frozen at that very moment when you add the formaldehyde, because it has two arms with three amino groups that can actually cross-link things onto everything together as long as they are in close proximity. Okay? They are close to each other. After the chemical cross-linking, why do you need to cross-linking? Because some of those interactions may not be very stable through the whole procedure, so you want to freeze everything at that moment. You freeze them, use the chemical cross-linker. After cross-linking, you subject the sample, of course you have the lyse cells, and then you subject the cell lysate to sonication, a method to use ultrasound to break up the longer piece of DNA into shorter pieces. And this sonication is a little bit tricky because you have to do a lot of pilot studies to find the conditions, the proper energy output, so that you will create, on average, 500 to 600 base pair DNA after sonication. So now you can see that your nucleosomes plus your specific protein binding to the DNA all get chopped up into small pieces of average 500 to 600 base pair long. After the sonication, you can actually add in the antibody specific for this protein that you want to study. And obviously, you have antibody available either in your laboratory or you can purchase from a commercial source, but you know the identity of your protein, so that's not hard to get antibody that can recognize the protein you are interested in. You add antibody, which is not drawn over here. This antibody is also attached to a bead, agarose or something, so that it's a immobilized antibody, so you can do it a precipitation, not drawn over here. So you add your bead and you collect the antibody, and the antibody will bind to this specific protein. Remember, this protein is cross-linked to your DNA, so this piece of DNA in red color, which is different from all the black-colored DNA, will also be precipitated together with your protein. And that is a very key piece of information. You want this DNA together with this protein to come down. That's why you use formaldehyde to cross-link this. Okay? You freeze everything at that moment. But after precipitation, you actually are not interested in those two proteins anymore. You're actually interested in this piece of DNA that this protein binds. So in order to free up this DNA, you reverse the cross-link by hydrolysis. It sounds pretty sophisticated. It actually only involves incubation at the elevated temperature for a number of hours, a few hours, then the DNA will be released from the protein because this formaldehyde crossing is reversible at higher temperature. Okay? So now you have free DNA and those proteins still bind to the antibody. We don't care about those anymore, but we care about this DNA. We want to know what is the DNA that binds to our protein. Okay? How would you analyze this DNA? There's only a tiny, tiny, minute amount of this DNA coming through this whole procedure. So you have to amplify the signal. You use your PCR reaction to amplify this DNA to know exactly what this DNA looks like. So you will create DNA oligoprimers that will amplify different regions of this original piece of chromatin DNA. Okay? This oligo DNA primer will amplify only this region, this primer set will only amplify this region. This primer set will amplify a region around the promoter transcription star site. So this will be inclusive in this red piece of DNA. This PCR DNA oligo primer will amplify a region that's downstream from the transcription star site. This is even further downstream. You add your sample, your material, after reverse crosslink into your PCR reaction. Not this guy. This guy is used only as an illustration to tell you where those primer sets are located. This does not come down, right? This does not get come down because this is already after sonication. We don't have any of the long piece of DNA anymore. So we get shorter piece of DNA, only the red one, because only the red one is brought down by your antibody. So when you add your PCR primer sets after PCR reaction, you will get negative signal for this reaction because there is no template. You will also get negative signal for this reaction because there is no template. No signal for this reaction, no signal for this reaction. Only this middle reaction will score a positive sign, meaning that you have a signal. Okay? From this information, you know that your pink color transcription factor interact with this piece of DNA that's upstream from the transcription star site. But this information is only rough, right? It doesn't give you the precise base pair information. It only gives you information in the range of about 500 to 600 base pairs. Why is that? Why is that? Because our cross-linking creates, our sonication creates only the 500, 600 base pair fragment. That is our resolution range, okay? So if you have a signal, you can be sure that the factor you're interested in is binding to a region about 500, plus minus 500, 600 base pairs in this neighborhood. Okay? So this is a chromatin immunoprecipitation method. It's very, very, very useful these days. So next time we're going to look at the specific example, real data that using this method. Please remember I have my office hours from 3 to 5 this afternoon.